So, to start with, I would like to thank everyone for coming tonight. It's a chilly Canberra winter, and it's great to see people have come out. I would like to acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Ngunnawal people and to acknowledge their elders past and present. The contribution of Indigenous peoples to governance and the way we do things in Australia is probably unsung as much as it could be. I would like to thank our guest of honour, our speaker tonight, Senator and Chief Minister Emeritus. Is that probably an appropriate title? Senator Katie Gallagher, who's recently been appointed to the Senate, obviously, as representative for the Australian Capital Territory. Of course, I first interviewed Katie about 2 years ago as part of a Fabian's Forum with Rosemary Follette, so it's ironic that we're coming full circle and talking about similar issues about how you make government work and the way in which politics and policy can be done better. To give you an overview of Katie's history, for those of you who know anything about Australian Capital Territory politics, she, of course, was Chief Minister for a period of about 3.5 years, it's probably that right. Prior to that, she was Chief Minister for about 5 years, Deputy Chief Minister for about 5 years. The way in which the ministerial appointments work in the ACT basically means at various points she's been Minister for everything. At one point, I think you
except
were...
Except planning.
At one point, I think you were Treasurer and Deputy Chief Minister and Minister for Health, which will probably give most people some kind of deep, severe crisis, but you managed to get through it.
Collect the money, spend the money.
Probably a good way of putting it. She's had a range of portfolios and brings to our event tonight an incredible expertise, which we're very lucky to have. So I thank her for coming. So basically tonight there will be some questions from myself. There'll be a time to get some questions from the audience. And the theme tonight is what makes government good. So we're very cognizant of the fact that a few months ago the Prime Minister said that good government starts today. And that made me start thinking about, well, how do we think about government? What's it supposed to do? How do you recognize whether it's good or not? So I will ask Katie or Sander, which do you prefer? Okay, Katie, the first obvious question, what do you think makes government good? And if that doesn't work, we'll use this one.
Okay, I'll try. Hello? Does that work?
No.
I've got a big voice, but do we need a mic?
Just in
case.
Swap
this one.
Thank you.
What makes government good? Well, I think, first of all, for me, leading government was to deliver against what I campaigned on in an election. So the agenda that you roll out through the campaign is something that the community is engaged with, certainly here in Canberra, and will measure you against. It's not to say that everything you say do would be easy or can be delivered, but when it can't, again, a good government fronts up and explains all the reasons why it can't. And it can't be just simply that you don't want to do it. It has to be for another reason. I think good government is a government that takes the community into its confidence, that pulls a community together and doesn't seek to divide a community, that shows leadership when leadership is needed, but when it's not, isn't busily interfering over and above what is necessary. I think good government supports good democracy, so encourages debates, doesn't get defensive of criticism and disagreements, but moreover uses that to inform and adjust policy settings if it's required. I think good government ensures a non-partisan public service and resources all the arms of accountability and transparency of government appropriately, and that's something that I felt very passionately about, so I made sure, bodies like the Auditor General, the Ombudsman, the Independent Statutory Office Holders actually resourced and encouraged to fulfil the roles that they should. I think that's a very good balancing act on some of the excess of executive government that can come in time. And I think probably for me, open government, that would be the last thing I'd add to that. So a government that's prepared to share its information, that looks to encourage citizen involvement in decision making, that doesn't seek to hide behind, you know, executive or non-executive release of documents, that, you know, seeks to take down and break down some of the mysteries of executive government. So we had this thing where I used to release cabinet summaries at the end of a week after the cabinet meeting. So we'd release it online, and no one ever read it. I think it was me, my staff, and probably the leader of the opposition staff were the only people that went through and read it. But that wasn't the point. The point was, if people wanted to understand what the cabinet was considering, who came and addressed the cabinet, what meetings had been happening, then it was there and available for people to read and use and ask follow-up questions. Finally, as leader of government, I think the only other thing I'd add is I very strongly felt it was my job to front up and explain particularly the less popular decisions, the ones that would get, you know, have angst in the community or areas of disagreement. I strongly believe that it's the job of executive government to front up and answer those and, you know, face the discussion and live with it, whether you change the decision or you don't. That's the job that the community elects you to do.
Thank you. One of the metrics that, I mean, we're seeing currently over the last few weeks has been that television program on the ABC about the last government. And too often it seems to be that, oh, a bad government is one that loses an election, that somehow it's just electoral success that can be seen as a metric. So people often refer to John Howard as a very successful prime minister or a very successful government because he won so many terms. But it's difficult for progressives to look at that government and go, it was good, because it did a lot of things that progressives disagree with. So do you think it requires historical distance, that you can't really judge government until 10 or 20 years down the line and you have a good sense of what they've done?
Well, I certainly think that'll be part of the Gillard administration, is that there does need to be distance between those years and once some of the emotion that's attached to her government subsides, which, you know, it will to some degree over time, people will be able to look at the reform agenda that she implemented. And I think whether you like her or you didn't like her, there's no doubt she led a reformist government. And I think for progressive politicians, reform is hard. Progressive governments reform. They have a clear reform agenda and they roll out those reforms, and reforms tend to polarise and divide. Conservative governments, and we can see this to some extent with the approach the Abbott government has taken now in his second year, conservative governments, like, basically the most radical thing they do is to stand still, you know, and not go backwards. And I think John Howard was very good at that, sort of just keeping the situation calm, not, you know, aside of things like perhaps the gun buyback scheme, which was particularly divisive for him in his own constituency. A steady hand on the ship proved to be quite electorally successful, but people don't get into progressive government or progressive politics to steady the ship. They get to, they're change merchants. They, you know, they want to see change to make sure that the community is, you know, that we're bringing all parts of the community together. And I think that's what NDIS was about. It's what Gonski was about. Here in the ACT, it's what tax reform ultimately is about, and some of the work we did locally. So, you know, we're not here to seat warm, but the flip side of that is you're bound to instill, you know, a level of angst in the community as that reform agenda is rolled out. But certainly for most governments, and I think when you go to Gough Whitlam's government, again, people at the time, it was incredibly polarising, yet even amongst sort of moderate conservatives now will look back and think, wow, that government actually did a huge amount to change Australia for the better,
all things that we cherish now in a very short period of time.
Thank you. Going back to the early days of your political involvement, you ran for the Assembly in 2001. Did you have a clear understanding of what you wanted to achieve as a Labor member? Did you have a vision?
I'd like to say I did. I really would. My one goal, and it was the goal of a number of women in the Labor Party at the time, because I didn't really like politics. I didn't like public speaking. I certainly didn't like standing on shopping centre corners with placards and posters of me, handing out brochures of me, which is what I had to do in the end. But there were no women in the Labor Party. And there was going to be no women in the government because it was clear that John Stanhope was going to knock off Kate Carnell. I think all of us at the time could see that that was going to happen. But the potential was that that would happen with seven or eight men and no women. And I think for us women in the Labor Party, we just found that to be, to go against every reason why we participated in the party. So that was the reason. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know John Stanhope from Burra Soap. I knew nothing about how the Assembly worked. I just was someone who cared. I cared about the city I lived in. I was a single mother with a very small child. And things like, I think for that 3 years I'd been a mother, I'd learnt the importance of the sole parent pension, so this sort of income security, for access to free healthcare, subsidised childcare. It was a great immersion. Parenthood was a great immersion into what makes Australia strong and how we pull people together and look after people when they need a helping hand. And that's sort of what drove me. Even though they were all matters that really related to the Commonwealth government, I didn't feel that the Liberal government here was operating along those lines, and that's what got me involved in Labor and then ultimately stood as a candidate. I was a candidate that wasn't meant to win. I was told I wouldn't win. I was told, Katie, fill out the ticket. You won't win. No one knows you. No one's going to vote for you, but it'll help. And then I was the seventh member elected. I was the final person elected, I think, 2 weeks after the election, and I won by 70 votes out of, 77,000 cast. It was ridiculous. And then the next election, 4 years later, I got myself a quota, so I didn't have to sit around and wait 2 weeks.
Thank you. So you got elected by that 70 votes, and then you're a minister within, I think, a year of... So was it a shock getting to the Assembly and learning how it worked and then having this transition phase into ministry? Like, did you have a clear sense of, okay, I've been here for a year now, now I do have an understanding of what can be achieved? Or do you think people, when they get involved in politics, they need a reality check because government can't do everything that perhaps we'd like it to do?
Yeah, so that first year... I did what I'd done in other jobs, which was just knuckle down and work hard and kind of get across what the hell it was I'd been elected to do. And, I can tell there's plenty of funny stories at that time. There was one, my first caucus meeting, and I'm in the left of the Labor Party, and so the caucus had all the members with one government, Wayne Berry called a left caucus meeting, so there was me, Simon and Wayne, that was it. And so I turned up and we sat down and Wayne goes, well, Katie's got to be Deputy Chief Minister. That's it. he goes, well, it's affirmative action. She's a woman. She's got to get up there and be Deputy Chief Minister. And I was almost off my chair. I was thinking, oh, I don't know. I knew enough to say, oh, Wayne, I don't know about that. And we did get through that, and I wasn't made Deputy Chief Minister, thankfully, at that time. But, I focused on the committee work. I did a lot of committee work, and then ultimately John appointed me as the minister. I don't know whether this is reflecting poorly on me, so I should probably stop telling the funny stories, but when I was elected minister, John said, because these things are kept quite tight before it happens, there was a lot of speculation who was going to be the fifth minister. Was it John Hargraves, who'd been there longer than me? Was it going to be John, Katie or Karen? And so there wasn't, you never had discussions with anyone about it for fear of, you know, it leaking that so-and-so has been talking to so-and-so, and I just stayed right out of it. But the caucus meeting where I was elected, as I'm leaving the meeting, John turned to me and said, oh, by the way, you're going to be education minister. Like, I'd just been elected a minister. I didn't know what I was a minister for. And he said, oh, and I've called a press conference just outside those doors. So I literally had from here, this sort of wood panelling floor to these doors and he said, so you better think of something you want to say about that. And I was just going, right, okay, right. And he walked over, opened the doors and the cameras started flashing and I don't know if anyone's got that footage of that press conference, but I seem to recall that when someone said, so what do you want to bring to the education system? I'd had no briefing, so I'd only found out 2 seconds before what it was going to be. And it just happened to be, I think my daughter was going into kindergarten. And so I said, well, look, I went to public schools here and my daughter's starting school, so that's going to be a good start for me. And everyone went, oh, okay. And I said, no, I have more to say on that later, which I did in time, but I had no idea, and thankfully people were quite kind to me. But I took that, I learned a lot in those first few years, and perhaps the critical learning points were when everything went wrong and how you respond to that. So when everything's fine whilst government's trucking along nicely, when there's nothing to worry about and you've got your public service working properly, the rubber hits the road for politicians when the wheels come off, and then you're judged by how you respond to that. What do you know? Who do you know? Who did you talk to? What did you do? How long did you allow this to go on? All those sort of questions are the ones that you learn very quickly. So for, you know, there was moments when the bushfires came and I was actually out of town and I got a phone call saying, I don't know if we told you in the incoming briefs that you're actually minister responsible for all community recovery. You know, no, you didn't tell me that, no. And now we're opening evacuation centres everywhere. There's the recovery centre had to be ramped up. So things like that, the child protection system went into meltdown. You know, minister, sorry, did we tell you that we had breached consistently for the last 3 years, breached section, you know, 272 of the Children and Young People's Act? No, you did not tell me that either. And, you know, again, it's what did you know, when did you know it, how did you respond, what did you find out, what's the consequence of this, how many people were hurt, all that sort of stuff. That's what ministers have to learn very quickly. And they have to front up and take responsibility whether they had anything to do with it. Most of my career in politics, all of the stuff ups, I had very little to do with until the point that I was told about them, and then you're embroiled in them as well. And that's the real skill for a minister, is learning how to navigate that and lead people through it. So it's not only fronting up and saying this is all that happened, it's actually what are you going to do about it, and how are you going to change it, how are you going to make sure it never happens again, and when it involves large numbers of staff, how are you going to bring them with you. So it's a huge learning curve, but those themes were been repeated in every portfolio I had. So that's a very long answer.
It's fine. So then, riffing off that answer, the current government, as previous governments, there's always issues around process and who know what when and how do you manage cabinet and how do you get appointments right and all those sorts of things. So from your experience, are there some key lessons you've learned? You've mentioned that often you didn't know what was going wrong until you got dumped in it. Did that mean you needed or you thought that the public service needed to inform you better, or what? How are things internally in terms of how government worked, if you can divulge some of that, that make government work better in the future?
Yeah, look, I think there is an element to how departments brief, but there's also reasons why departments don't brief ministers, to give you appropriate distance from particular decision-making or to keep you in reserve for when you need to get involved. So it's not as though departments have to brief you on every minute detail, but certainly departments that worked for me or with me, as I prefer to have the relationship known, knew that I expected to be informed of any issue that, you know, fell within a certain criteria. I think in terms of my own approach, and again, this has caused a lot of grey hairs and put me in conflict with media advisors and political advisors, is my view was to always front up and just tell the truth, you know, not to be smart about the details or withhold details or say that's in confidence, or, you know, if there were moments when you weren't sure of the information, or, you know, it was going to prejudice an inquiry down the track, sure, you know, those were legitimate reasons perhaps to withhold information. But I always felt it was much more important to go and tell everyone everything you knew, and that puts me in contrast, I think, to Tony Abbott's government, who has a different approach, which is to tell people nothing so they don't worry about anything. And we see that with, you know, say the Operation Sovereign Borders. The approach is don't bring anyone into your confidence, tell them nothing, therefore there are no questions. Whereas I have a much different approach to, and it's different issues, but that I felt that we should always try and bring people into our confidence. And it always paid off, you know, whenever political polling or whatever's done, people would always say, even if they didn't like me, they would say they thought I told the truth, and that when I fronted up, that what I was saying was believable. So I think that was important to me. But certainly a dysfunctional department is going to reflect poorly on a minister, and a dysfunctional minister is going to reflect poorly on a department. So there is a mutual interest in having departments run properly and ministers being well briefed to the point that they need to be, but not over briefed.
Thank you. So when you became Chief Minister, that's a very different perspective. You've got a kind of helicopter, if I can call that. You know, you're expected to know all sorts of things mm-hmm. that you might not have previously been before. Or how was that different for you in terms of getting across things and the expectations that people would have? Did John Stanhope give you any advice, or did you pass anything on to Andrew Barr about how you managed that jump from being a minister to a chief minister?
Well, I thought I knew it all, as you do going into these jobs, that because I'd acted for John quite a bit, and in fact before he retired he'd gone for, I think, 10-week holiday to, well-earned and well-deserved holiday to Europe. So he sort of left me in charge for long periods of time, running the cabinet, running the government, running the messaging, you know, implementing the policies. But nothing can actually prepare you for when you're permanently in that job, because I think, one, the public service holds stuff back, you know, for when the real person arrives. So you don't actually have to deal with or absolutely everything. You probably have about 90%, but not 100%, and that 10% is probably all the hard stuff that, you know, they're waiting for the Commander-in-Chief to come back and deal with. And the other thing you learn is it is actually quite a lonely place to be, because there isn't anyone behind you. As deputy, if I had an issue, if it was causing me grief, I could go and speak with John. And, you know, John and I had that relationship where, you know, we were very close from a, in a professional sense, working together, trusted each other completely, could tell each other anything. But he was always there, and all of a sudden he was gone. And I was hardly going to be the person that had him on speed dial for John, you know, like another issue. He was good and he was there, and I did use him on occasion. But nothing really can prepare you for that point where the buck stops with you, and people expect you to be able to respond to them, resolve their concerns, pick up on what they want to raise with you. Business are in your ear all the time. The unions want things done. People you meet on the street, you know, have a gripe about something that you're not fully across. So, yeah, it's a very challenging role, but it was great as well, because you are in a position where you can actually make a difference, and you can you know, hear a story on a weekend and turn around and go, that's just ridiculous, you know, and getting to someone when they get into work on Monday and change it. And even, you know, because we have the council functions as well, things that drive you nuts on the road or near your kids' school or something like that. That's the frustration I have now. I can't ring anybody and go, what are you doing? So it is, it's a great job as well. But, yeah, nothing quite prepares you for it. And, again, you get thrown in, and you just have to learn how to swim faster than everybody else who's swimming after you.
Thank you. I think we'll take our first audience question. Hands, show of hands, yes, you.
Have you got a reputation here?
Do you want me to just speak? Is that easy?
Yeah,
just,
actually, it would be. Sorry about that.
Or awkwardly hold the microphone.
Yeah, either or. Senator, thank you very much for your comments this evening. It strikes me that the concept of good, be it government or anything else, is a fairly objective rather than subjective concept. And so you're being forced to choose between a series of things which are perhaps in their own way a bit of good or a lot of good. So whether it's putting more money towards schools or hospitals or roads or any number of things, they're all empirically good things to do. How do you actually choose between that and in that sense emphasise a better or overall good government when you have so many things to actually have to narrow down to a few options to prioritise as a leader of a government?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I'm not sure there is the perfect answer for it, because if there was, I'd love to know and would have been very helpful in all those budgets I sat in. I mean, essentially the budget becomes the annual document which explains all that. It says, you know, if anyone read the budget, it's really a statement of the government's values and what they want to achieve over the next, say, 12 months, but with sort of blocks for the forward estimates. And so that's a constant balancing act, you know, and it's getting harder and harder each year as the demands on government become greater and the revenue available to government becomes becomes smaller. Certainly in the Commonwealth area, that's true. Here it's growing marginally. But, you know, with areas like health taking a third of your budget, you know, and growing at about 10% a year, so it's already 33% of your budget, between about 31, maybe 33 now, 33% of your budget growing at 10% a year, at some point that's going to consume your entire budget. So every year, you know, the money available for roads and for disability and for, you know, community programs and community facilities becomes tighter and tighter because you've got these insatiable parts of the budget that are just consuming everything. And I think government's also perhaps, you know, really the discretionary money available to governments is very limited. But I think if you look at, say, a great way of analysing progressive and conservative governments and maybe taking some judgments about whether they're good or bad is to take, you know, Campbell Newman's first budget and then measure it against, say, Andrew Barr's first budget as Chief Minister, and you get very different value sets, similar budget problems in terms of deficits and expenditure, but the decisions that are taken, the path to recovery, the optimism that's shown in terms of opening up new areas for economic growth as opposed to shutting them down sort of speaks to that value set. But look, I say it is. Budget cabinet in the ACT starts in December and finishes in late April. And there are hours of agonising discussion about these incredibly good programs that you would like to fund that you just don't have the resources for. And then it's a, you know, it really is a process of, you know, well, could we get away with $1.5 million for that road, shave that by $500,000 and put $500,000 into that, you know, community preschool to get, you know, Koori kids to achieve benchmark kindergarten. It's that kind of decision that, and it is guided by values, very much so. So, yeah, I think that's the best I can offer for that.
Thank you, that was a good question.
What about the answer?
I think the answer was also good. I shouldn't judge the guests.
It's all right.
basically, so One thing I'd like to just explore for a second is this idea of the ACT, and, you know, you've got a relatively small ministry, a relatively small assembly. We geographically locate, you know, quite small. People get cranky if you have to drive for more than half an hour anywhere. And coming from Victoria, I found this incredibly interesting. But it seems to be because you've got the council function and you've got the territory function, and because you know your local member in ways possibly than you can't in other territories. Like, you could meet someone down the shops and argue with them about the pothole. Is that an experience that you reflected on, that if you were a politician in another jurisdiction, you might have a different relationship with the people around you and with the people you're governing?
Yeah, for sure. And look, if it wasn't going to start off the hugest debate about how we run government, I would say it's a very good model to have local and municipal and state functions together. But, you know, that's it's a fight for someone else. Look, I think being a politician in Canberra, it's in a place like Canberra, has made me a better politician, because you can't front up, you can't avoid an engaged community wherever you go, really. You know, whether it be at the supermarket, at your kids' sport, you know, at a play, at the shops, people will be into you. And they, not only will they know the issue, they've probably written the policy paper that led to it. So you have to really be across your game. And I think that's certainly made me a much better politician, in that I can understand and deal with the important issues like potholes. And look, they are important for people, and, you know, and services at their local shops, and the playground that's faulty getting fixed, that really does matter to people. It affects their quality of life. And being able to front up with that, and then also justify, you know, why we've signed on to something else in the national scheme, makes me a much better, well-rounded politician. I can't think of too many other communities where you go and get that kind of engagement. And, you know, particularly now in the Senate, I've had the most hilarious conversations with senators, some who haven't met a constituent in decades, and wouldn't know what to do with one if they came across one. That the senator's role is to sit on committees, to write reports, and to travel to Canberra 22 weeks a year. Any constituent inquiries or matters pertaining to constituents go to the local House of Reps member. And so being in the Senate, it's just a... And that's different here. I say, well, that's not like it here. Like, I'm out the front of my office down there and everyone's into me, no problems. I'm meeting people all the time. So I think Canberra, again, just shows how different it is. People are visible here. Everyone knows, you know, everyone knows me, and where, you know, are very happy to come up to me. Whereas I guess if you're Joseph Ludwig in Queensland, you know, as a, probably people don't know you, so you don't have that contact. But I much prefer the model we have here.
Thank you. Riffing off that again, there's that... The ACT does have a particular engaged electorate. You've got a lot of public servants who've written the policy papers and everything.
Yep.
But more broadly, more and more with social media, we're seeing that people have access to expertise that they might not have had instantly a year or 5 years ago. For example, when the DLP federally released its policy on superannuation, I think within a couple of hours you had Fairfax talking to John Daly and basically said, from the Grattan Institute, and saying, actually, this isn't nearly as good as it could be. How do you manage policy development and politics in an environment where anyone can speak to a very expert talking head who can instantly go, actually, you're doing this wrong, and you have to be able to try and defend your policy position, you know, in that environment?
Well, I think part of it is you make sure you've done the work before you release the policy. That is, you've spoken to all the stakeholders, you're aware of where the attacks are going to come from, and you're aware of where your supporters are. You know, because the minute you hit go on that policy button, as you say, it's live, and it's going to be, if it's a matter of, you know, interest, which
you know, some may argue superannuation isn't to most, but there will be a particular group that follow that. And that's what social media allows you to do, doesn't it? It allows you to sub-specialise your news into things that you just like. So, yeah, you've got to be prepared that 5 minutes later you've got the experts, if not around the country, around the world, having a look at things and passing judgment on it. And so it makes the case for careful policy development even stronger, and I actually think even better, particularly if you can use social media to assist you in the policy development phase so that you're not just talking to the same people, but you're pulling in views from anyone who and anywhere that can contribute. And, you know, I think we do it to a little bit. I think it's an area that political parties are going to have to get a lot better at, is opening themselves up and allowing voices from outside to come in and influence the debates. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have more critics than supporters if you're not careful. But yeah, I think that's probably it at the end of the day. Make sure you know where once you release it, make sure you know where those attacks are going to come from and be ready with the response. And look, you know, I go back to tax reform here in the ACT. Incredibly difficult. We're what, in year four now? We knew when I actually commissioned the tax review that led to the tax reform as treasurer, because I could see what was happening to our revenue base. Now, I want to fund, at the time, wanted to fund hospitals and schools and everything else we wanted to do. It was clear to me we had to have a better way of pulling in our revenue and not just take, you know, almost a quarter of our revenue was being generated from 7% of the population. You know, and those 7% were borrowing to provide us with that money, because they were borrowing for stamp duty, to give us the stamp duty for us to run the schools. That's where tax reform started, and I thought, that's really unfair. Here am I on this high income, but because I'm not choosing to move, I'm not paying as much tax as someone who chooses to upgrade from a two-bedroom house to a three-bedroom house because they've added another child to the family and earn, you know, half of what I earn. That's where it started, but it's divisive. The policy intent is good and it's solid and it stands up to the experts' test, but it's a policy debate you have to win on the ground as well. And, you know, I'm not saying we got it perfect, because what we underestimated, and I think we did at the time, was while 7% of the population would be happy, 93% wouldn't be. They would be less happy. They're not all against it, but they would be less happy. And they're the things that you've got to go into with your eyes open, I think.
Thank you. So you've got to develop the building blocks, the policy, you've got to consult, you've got to bring people on board, you've got to be aware of where your critics and your supporters are. Often, increasingly, governments use external advisory bodies, whether it's at the federal level, things like the Human Rights Commission, there may be particular committees of review or audit or those sorts of things. How do you make sure, as a politician, that you get people on board through an advisory process and you get them, you know, there are often people you appoint to committees and things who are never going to agree with you,
mm-hmm.
who have very specific different perspectives. Yeah. How do you deal with that particular position when there may be a committee and they come out with a report and they say you're not doing enough for X, or your system needs to be completely reformed, or you're underfunding Y? How do you deal with those sorts of positions when you've appointed people to publicly accidentally condemn you and you now have to kind of deal with the repercussions of that? So, I mean, should we not have external advice because those sorts of situations occur?
No, in fact, I think the opposite. I mean, you know, one of the dangers of executive government, and particularly governments that get practiced at how to run executive government, is only listening to yourself and pretending that it's only everybody else that's got the problem, that you're right and it's everyone else who's got it wrong. So those external advisory bodies are really important. I think that probably the only thing I didn't add to the last question, and it's relevant to this one, is... but when you believe something is right, you stick by it, you know? And that means you stick by it when you're getting abuse hurled at you at public meetings, when people are having a go at you in the street, you know, as you're dragging your children along.
if you think it stacks up in your head, you believe in it, that it's the right thing to do, that it's guided, for me, by Labor values, and ultimately that it's going to deliver a better community, then you stick by it and you don't waver. And so that's relevant to those who seek to criticise from inside a small, you know, not inside the executive tent, but in the tent just on the perimeter. They have a go at you, it's fine. You know, don't get defensive. Don't come out and shoot them down and tell them that they've failed. There's no need to be defensive. This is what we've seen with Tony Abbott and Gillian Triggs and, Tony's involved, but it's George and Scott Morrison, is, a person charged to do a certain job puts forward their views and they are shot down by the government that essentially employs them through. That creates a pretty dangerous world, I think. And for me, I've disagreed with plenty of people. I can't think of report after report that's come out condemning and deploring something I've been involved in. You can disagree with people and still be respectful to them and still argue your case about why you think that what you did was the right thing. And people are prepared to listen to it. And we don't give the community enough respect to believe that they can work, they can then navigate through that and make up their own view. But actually by being defensive, I think it reflects very poorly on politicians. And one thing I learned as health minister is you're never going to ever going to win against a doctor. Never try it. Even though they were wrong most of the time. And it's the same for independent statutory office holders. If you stand up an independent statutory office holder and a politician, unless that statutory office holders being corrupt or a deviant in some way, they will win against a politician every time. And so your job then is not to condemn and deplore them, but to argue your position and why you believe your position is right.
Thank you. So I guess, following on from that, is there any... How do we engage with this sense of building consensus in the community when you often have people appointed who will essentially, as you say, you know, more likely to be trusted, and they'll be like, here's why all the things that the government is doing is wrong. You're trying to provide a particular alternative view. Do you think it's possible? Do you think that, how can I put it? Do you think that our distrust in politicians leads people to be worried about policy formation, because they've got the experts on the other side telling them why everything you as a politician is doing is wrong, and you're kind of struggling uphill pushing that boulder?
I think our level of distrust of politicians is, it's for more reasons than this, but I don't think politicians instill a behaviour that generates trust as a profession. There's too many examples of us not telling the full story, telling the half story, being tricky, ignoring the story, blaming someone else for the story, rather than being upfront and honest about what the story actually is. And so people aren't stupid, you know. I've learned that over many years. The community gets it, they're interested in it, and they don't want to be taken as mugs. And I think there's a lot that politicians can do for themselves to kind of pull that back and to generate a sense of trust. And one of them is leadership. You know, provide leadership on issues that the community is seeking leadership from. That's what they elect you to do. I always felt it very strongly that my job as a politician was not... Even though I was in a privileged position, I got the fact I wasn't better than anyone else, that I remained, at my heart, a member of the Canberra community who had been elected by the people of Canberra to be their representative in executive government. And I always understood that as my role. And so that meant that, one, when people are doing their very busy lives and, you know, working and raising families and caring for people and getting about their business, that they had elected me to keep an eye on things. That's what they wanted me to do. And so when there was a problem, they think, well, what's Katie going to do about that? Because that's the job that we've asked her to do. So I think that's, for me, it was always very clear what I, my position. I feel that now in the Senate, that's my job now. I sit there representing almost 400,000 Canberrans, you know, and that will guide me in the work that I do. But I think there's other reasons, the media cycle, the, you know, the hurl and burl of public life, that influences the way we interact back as politicians with the community. But I think there's a lot of things we can do ourselves with the type of leadership we want to bring to the national debates that worry us and for which the community is seeking leadership from.
Thank you. One thing from me before we go to another audience question, this question of representation, particularly, I guess, two connected things. Do you feel a particular, not authority, but do you feel a particular weight because you're a female representative in the Senate and therefore you're potentially a role model for women's involvement in politics? And secondly, do you think when you look at our parliament, it's not as diverse as our community? And do you think that's a particular issue around the way in which we select people for elected office?
Yes, look, I've always thought that parliament should reflect the communities they're there to represent, and the more diversity you have, the better representation you have in the chamber. And that's clear even from the last term of the Assembly. You know, we had Chris Burke as an Indigenous member elected. That brought a new perspective to caucus discussions around, you know, matters that affected Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Andrew Barr is gay. That, again, brings another perspective to the caucus, the party room, about discussions and policies that you bring in around that. You know, everyone brings their own story, and it's really important that parliaments reflect the communities they represent. Very important. And that's why, you know, 50% of them should be women, frankly. And we've got a terrible story there when we look nationally. We've been growing at about 1% per annum in terms of female representation in the Senate for the last 20 years or so. So going on this rate, it's going to be 2070, I think. I did the numbers, as I do in the Labor Party. Mm. You know, you crunch it through. Before, and that's provided that men stop still and that women sort of gain a much faster progression before we're going to get to 50% of women in parliaments in Australia. So we're currently just under 30%, but 75% of ministries, you know, all executive positions in Australia are held by men. So, you know, we always, whenever I go to a women's function, a women's political function, you know, where we get together and talk about how great it is, how far we've come, and it's all good, you know, that's important. I now prefer to switch it on its head and go, look how far we haven't come, in the sense that let's talk about what we don't have. We don't have 70% of the seats in parliaments. We don't have 75% of the ministries. And we, when you go to COAG, it's a very lonely place to be. You know, it's less than 10% there. And I think that politics is worse off for that. And, you know, I'll certainly do whatever I can to get more women to stand in the ACT election next time, because, don't worry, the boys have got it all worked out. They will take those 8 new seats before we've even blinked our eyes, unless the women are there kind of rallying them up and trying to gain a little spot at the table, because there's 8 seats to go. And, you know, I was talking at Emily's List function a month or so ago, and I'd been talking to all these women. I'm trying to encourage more women to stand as pre-selected candidates, and I've had coffee with them, we've chatted, and everyone's, oh, I don't know, I've got 9 out of 10 of the skills, but I, you know, it's just that last one that I don't really like, can just tick off. And I've had all these meetings. I have one meeting with a guy who's going to be a candidate, and he walked in and he goes, here's my nomination form, can you sign it? That's how it happens. And so we have to do a lot more for women who tend to agonise a bit more over these things to get them to get involved and to be prepared to take on the challenge. And it's not easy. Like, I have been mistaken as the drinks morning tea lady at one event when I was representing the Chief Minister, I've had stories about how my hair won the election one year after I'd worked my butt out to win it, or to be part of it. It was my hairstyle that took the night. There's so much sexism, but I just felt that I had to keep trudging on because Julia Gillard was right. It will be easier for the women that come behind every time. Every time someone continues on. I breastfed my babies in cabinet. Do you know how hard that is? It's awful. And anyone who's breastfed a baby knows how much noise they make in a room. And like I did all of these things, and every time I was doing it, when it got too hard, I was thinking, you know what? It's going to be easier for the next person that comes, and the next person that comes, and the next person that comes. And it's essential that women are there. It really is, and it matters so much. But it's not just women. It's women with coming from diverse cultural backgrounds. It's single mums, it's lesbian mums, you know, like it's every type of woman should put their hand up, and the same for men.
Thank you. Audience question?
Yep.
I'll speak up.
Thank you.
Thanks, Katie. I suppose reflecting on the months you had as senator for the ACT, I suppose most people start a job, spend the first few months watching, learning how to do things. They then do them, and then usually a moment hits where they think, oh, there must be a better way of doing this.
Mm.
I suppose in the context of being a progressive, but also good governance, the principles of accountability, transparency, what are some of the things you've seen so far, Senator, that you'd like to change?
Oh.
And it's a long question.
It is, and it's getting recorded. Yeah, well, that is my style, actually, to go in and just spend a couple of months looking and watching. I'd certainly change. Look, it's hard because I don't want to come out with all these opinions that get me into trouble, but I think there's a live debate around the Labor Party and how we pre-select people into positions, which I think I'm a supporter of 100% rank and file pre-selection of all positions. I think that's important, and I think the parliamentary team would be strengthened by an approach like that, where people have had to front up and sit in meetings like this and demonstrate why they should be representing the Australian Labor Party in the parliament. I think, you know, one of the things I've learned, I'm just sitting on the committees now, it's early days, I sat through my first estimates. I felt at the end of estimates that we probably missed the real issues, that estimates became an exercise in whether the Governor-General had a thermo mix or not, how much had been spent on the sandwiches at a particular event, who got invited to that event, what were the airfares. So it's sort of the quick wins are there and they're easy, but the harder thing to get to is exactly what is going on and what are the big issues and how prepared is the government to face those types of issues. But that's part of, you know, and I don't have a perfect answer about how you deal with that. How do you deal with issues of substance versus those clickbait kind of issues that get people's attention to sort of demonstrate that you're doing good work? So I certainly felt that trying to get making sort of my involvement in the committee process a bit more thorough would be good. I don't know, I think I'm still formulating my views on other areas. It is very different, can I say, from taking someone who's pretty much for the last 8.5 years been the second in charge or in charge and putting me in a room of just over 80 people, probably as the most junior member. To try and, you know, it's a very different world. People have the policy areas they work on and the sort of shadow ministerial and ministerial experience, and so trying to find my space in that team is, you know, something I'll work out, but it'll take a bit of time to do it. I'll sit and watch, that's for sure, like a sponge.
Thank you, said the sponge. So... As a wrap-up, we've talked a lot about accountability, about improvement, about representation. Can you set out what your vision for a good government would be. Currently, the government is basically saying that, the federal government is basically saying that our number one priority is to keep you safe through national security. And if we do that, then it doesn't seem to really focus on much else. Do you have a particular priority for government or a particular vision for what is the main purpose of what government should be doing for Australians?
Well, I think very much that governments are about outlining a vision for the country they'd like to develop. So, you know, when you go back and have a look at election agendas, it's usually an agenda about, you know, projecting into the future about what we'd like to be, who we'd like to be, how we'd like to care for everybody, what services are important, what economic growth agenda do we have, what's going to be the jobs of the future, etc., etc. I think that's really important. At the moment, I fear that we're being governed by the politics of fear, you know, and that's easy politics in a sense. And what the balance to that is not really there at the moment, which is about how you protect all the things that have been fought for years, which is, you know, our rights and our freedoms and the society that we choose to live in. That sort of dropped off a little bit because it's very easy to reject a standing still, or it's not even a standing still position now, it's a standing still with the jacket getting tighter and tighter. And, you know, I think that's, again, I don't sit here and pretend that I have all the answers to everything. That's my view, and I think what we've got to work on as progressives is how do we get the rights, freedoms, accountability, transparency back into the discussion about our, you know, our national political debate at the moment. And it's very difficult to do that. There is no perfect way, because anyone who opens their mouth at the moment and doesn't start with the Daesh death cult or...
Five flags.
Yeah, well, 10. 10's the record. is seen as a... is somehow projected as a traitor or someone who's soft on terror. And that comes down like a massive hammer in under a second. And so it's really... it's stifling some of the debates that we should be having as a country that's really... been built upon, you know, egalitarianism, freedom, rights, respect, mateship, all of these things that we like to define ourselves by are being challenged at the moment. And, you know, I think it's a hard space for progressive politicians to navigate at the moment, but I know that there's lots of people who feel the same way that are trying to work through it.
Thank you. I'll take one more audience question. I'll take it from this side because I haven't taken anyone from this side yet. Yep. You.
Sorry, I didn't have any women asking questions for you tonight. Okay.
That's all right.
I'm glad to hear you on that. And I hope it's not made harder by the fact that you've moved on to a new role, but you're still in the area.
I'm like this, so I'm going to be all over people.
Yeah. My question is just a quick one about social media. I remember just towards the end of your term, you took the vote out and, you know, went on social media and did a Q&A as Chief Minister, and I was just wondering if you could tell us what that was like and anything you learned from that.
Oh, type faster, that was one of the things. I got caught out on the typing. Look, I never worry about chatting to people, and that, in a sense, is what social media is all about. I think it's got its constraints, and it is a bit tricky in the sense that I'd done a couple of Twitter cabinets. I don't know if you'd participated in those, and they're good, but it's hard to get things into 140 syllables and, you know, get the answer you need. So we tried the Facebook Q&A, and that was, I thought, a lot better. People, you know, it's a great way to engage with people, and again, I think it's, we're just going to see more and more of it. I mean, it's moving into video, which I don't like video so much, but I'm going to have to get used to it. My office keep telling me I'm going to have to post video messages and things, so I can't stop laughing every time they start filming me. So I have to get on with that. But, I think it's a great way to communicate, and certainly as a busy woman with youngish children at home, it's just an excellent way to, instead of being...
no offence, at a pub at 8 o'clock on a Monday night, to be at home on answering people's questions about what's going on and, you know, if they've got a gripe, to be able to answer that, it's just, it's incredible. It's great for politicians, and I hope it's good for the... We always got good feedback from people who'd participated, but I think we're just going to see more and more of it. I want to do another one, but I don't really have the or anything to... Like, people go, well, what are you doing about Parks Way or something? I'd go, well, nothing. I'm not doing anything about it. So I have to have a subject, I think, before I do another one.
Do you think it went, like, both ways, or do you think it's actually an exercise in consulting? You know, like, I'm listening now, and you can ask me questions, and then we move on and we forget that we did it. Or did you come out of that thinking, wow, I really would like to put some more energy into this area, I need to do some more work,
yeah,
or
no,
get a new
definitely.
Brief on that or something?
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I'm trying to think of an example, but there were definitely times during either Twitter cabinet or that Q&A that we went and followed something up and changed something. You know, if someone said, you know, it's stupid you do this, or we think, you know, this doesn't work or something. Actually, I think... You know, even ones like, why can't you put this form online? There was definitely lots of those that I went, yeah, why can't we? And someone goes, well, we can. And I went, well, you know, can you do that now? you know, so things did change from that, definitely. I mean, I much prefer it to be useful. And it's great, you know, the politics of that are really good too. Not only is it great to actually have feedback that you can then follow up and change things, but it's for a politician to go back to that person and go, hey, you know what, your idea... took it on board, implemented it. That's actually, you know, politically, it's good for me as well. Not just saying I'm doing it out of the kindness of my own heart, but, yeah, no, it's a very, very powerful... If you use it properly, I've seen politicians that don't engage properly on social media, and I think that's, you know, that's unfortunate. But then I think it's just a snapshot of the real world, isn't it? That person's probably really grumpy in a public meeting as well. You know, so it's a real, just like a, it's a snapshot of the real world, social media. It's good. So
well,
you know, when I do my next Q&A, though, I've got something, obviously, have some power and resource again.
Well, thank you very much. I think we've got, Frank, have you got the raffle? Katie, do you mind drawing the raffle?
All right. It's terrible, you know. I don't know. Only makes for one happy person. And everyone else is cranky.
Yes.
I'm trying to pull my own name. Blue 34?
Oh. Blue 34.
Hey.
Oh, okay, yeah. Congratulations. And thank you everyone for attending. Have a lovely evening and a safe trip home.